Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, we investigate journalism, specifically radio.
Audio is something that we're hardwired for. We're hardwired for story. We're hardwired for me wanting to hear what you have to say.
Investigating journalism, that's our Inflection Point. In an era of declining newsroom budgets, an expanding digital media landscape, and increasingly polarizing cable channels that make it hard to tell the true from the false, is real investigative journalism still up to the task? One national radio show, Reveal, has dedicated its entire mission to uncovering injustice. The show is a partnership between the award-winning Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Our guest, Suzanne Reber, created and ran NPR's investigative unit and is now the co-creator and executive editor of Reveal. Welcome to the program, Suzanne.
Thank you.
For anyone who hasn't yet heard Reveal, can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, it is the first of its kind. It's the only show in the U.S. and on the North American airwaves that's entirely dedicated to, like you said, investigative reporting. And what that means is that we are looking for stories that are going to take you into a hidden world, a place that you might never have been, a story that's been underreported or, frankly, that you've never heard about. And we're going to take you sort of down the rabbit hole with us, and we're going to explain, like, how we got the story. We're going to meet interesting characters along the way. And most of all, we're really looking for impact, because more often than not, these are stories that haven't been told before. And sometimes they're hidden from the audience because people are trying to keep things secret. So it's our job to uncover it, and we do have impact. Laws change, people go to jail, or the public just gets a sense of empowerment from hearing that somebody's actually watching. So that's what we're doing.
Why did you start it?
Well, my whole entire background has been in broadcast journalism and in news, and I very quickly migrated into investigative reporting. So I know quite a bit about how hard it is to get this kind of reporting on the air. It's very resource intensive. It takes a lot of time. And more often than not, it's a little bit out of sync with the sort of daily grind that goes on in radio stations, where everybody's dealing with the daily news and we're doing things that are more long form and take longer to produce. So sometimes it can be difficult to get air, and it's, you know, it's often lawyered. And so what I found is that there wasn't just enough air. It's incredibly interesting how even large networks like the CBC or NPR, where I've worked, have very episodic investigative reporting. So it'll kind of pop up, something big will happen, and months on end, nothing will happen. And so we just felt like the audience deserves more of it, and we wanted to create a platform where we could not only do our own reporting from the Center for Investigative Reporting, but also open it up to other newsrooms and organizations that are doing this kind of work, and basically say, hey, we have this show where we can actually showcase the kind of work we're doing. And that was the idea.
And you work with Frontline and PBS NewsHour and other investigative reporting shows to share your content. Is that part of Reveal the wider network, not just Reveal the radio show?
Well, in order to answer that question, I should probably tell you a little bit about the Center for Investigative Reporting. It's one of the first nonprofit investigative newsrooms in the country. It started, you know, more than 30 years ago here in the Bay Area. And it's an entirely independent newsroom entirely focused on investigative stuff. From the beginning, they partnered with all kinds of different outlets, you know, anywhere from 60 Minutes, the big dailies, New York Times, the San Francisco papers. And that was their idea, is putting this kind of content on the platforms that were interested in buying it or collaborating. Over the years, that was really the model that CIR was using, and it's been, I mean, I can't even name all the partners. I'm sure it's over 200 or something. I guess I can get that to you, but there's a lot of partners. But what was sort of missing, often our stories would get, like, kind of buried. You might not even know that it's the Center for Investigative Reporting. And so we also were at sort of on the timetable of the partner, so that might hold up publication. It might mean that a story could be sort of sitting there waiting to get a slot and is getting dated or things are happening. So we had always been thinking, what if we had our own platform? And obviously you can have a website, and these days you can also start a podcast, which we are doing. I mean, Reveal is also a podcast. But we also know from experience that the public radio audience is such an important audience. It's a very large audience. It's a very influential audience. People who make decisions, people who are in Congress, they listen to public radio, and we felt we wanted to share this information with that kind of audience. And so we basically decided to do our own show. So it's kind of an evolution for CIR, and now we're essentially making this platform available to others. So in the past, we would be on Frontline, and we have been, and we probably still will collaborate with all kinds of people. But now we're also saying, hey, you have a great show. Why don't we make a radio version for Reveal? And so it's kind of going both ways now, which is kind of interesting.
You mentioned that other investigative units at other existing stations or shows get lawyered. What did you mean by that? And how do you not have to deal with that? Or maybe you do.
Oh, no, we deal with it all the time. We're very used to dealing with lawyers. And really what that's about is that obviously the goal of our reporting is that we deal with the facts. We deal with primary records, documents, sources. If we say that somebody's died, we are going to look at the medical report or the coroner's report. We're going to go right to the heart of the story. And depending on what the story is, we're probably going to call a spade a spade. If somebody's done something wrong, we're going to say so. And so what we do, and the reason we lawyer, is because we're protecting ourselves and the stations where, you know, they run our show, that we have got our facts right. And we have lawyers that understand this kind of work and that give us advice on how to make sure that we're not inadvertently libeling people, or we have to make sure that the way we support our facts is done in a proper way.
Well, let's talk about some real examples of stories that Reveal has covered.
Our very first show we ever aired had a story from the Center for Investigative Reporting that had been reported by Aaron Glantz, who's actually right now on a sabbatical at Stanford. But Aaron has spent years documenting all manner of stories around veterans. And it's actually one of my favorite stories. And also, we're very proud because the very first pilot of Reveal won a Peabody. So for us, for our team, that's awesome.
Congratulations.
And so what happened with that story is, as a lot of people know, and hundreds of thousands of vets have come home, we know that many of them are addicted to painkillers. And that's something that sort of people sort of knew about. But when you take an investigative approach like what Aaron did, is we really looked at, well, what is actually the prescription rate? And looked at all the data and compiled the sort of, not just that there was a lot of addiction, but just how much there was and how much it had spiked. And we were able to really let people know how off the charts this was. And we were able to localize it with partners all over the country. We could actually tell which hospital systems had the worst records. And so it was a very important story, but it was told in a way that made it possible for so many people all over the country to really understand what went down. You may not even really know as you're listening to the story how much work went into it to even be able to tell you just how the VA had become the pill pusher of the nation. For us to be able to just state that as fact takes a lot of work.
How do you decide what to focus on? I mean, there's a million bad things happening at any given moment. That's just my general feeling. But, I mean, how do you narrow in on what's going to be the story to talk about?
Well, a lot of people doing investigative reporting, whether they're reporters or editors, they kind of have what I call an outrage button. And sort of the outrage button tends to be, or other people call it the spidey sense. You will hear all kinds of different versions of that. But it's just when you sort of know that something's off or something's not quite right, we're going to be really attracted to that kind of thing. And we're probably going to notice things like that in people's conversations. And we're going to go, wait a second, what's really going on? So our show is very much, we like to say, you know, there's more to the story. That's our motto. So you may think you know everything about how, you know, the veterans are addicted to painkillers, but we're going to go deeper and find out, like, just what is really happening and how much. And we're also going to be looking for stories where we think we might have a potential for change. Could the fact that we're going to do a deep dive in the story, could it make something happen that might make things better? I mean, journalists get into it because they feel it can change the world. And in a way, sometimes when you're doing investigative reporting, it actually happens like that. We can make something change. So we're looking for those kinds of more universal stories where there's a certain impact possible. And that, for instance, with Aaron's veteran stories, there were all kinds of different things that happened in terms of reactions. And, you know, Congress picked it up in different parts of the country, pill-pushing doctors, the VA got fired, and things can happen when you expose injustice. So we've got a whole bunch of little things going on when we're trying to decide if there's a story, or we'll take something highly local, like Jack's story that's coming up in the November edition, of something that happened in one place, but then as we started digging more with him, we showed the pattern that this had happened before, decades before. Why did people get away with it back then? So sometimes we'll show patterns as, you know, people travel across the country and repeat patterns, and we expose it and hopefully can sort of give people some understanding of their world, of what's going on around them, that might make them just more aware of, you know, if there's a scam happening in one state, it might be possible for it to happen somewhere else. So we're constantly looking for stories that might be able to travel in that way. Or they're just really human stories that we just feel are compelling and important for you to understand a world that you might have no access to. So, for instance, we did a sort of follow-up to a story that we had done at CIR, and that we actually did do with Frontline, called Rape in the Fields, that was documenting the sexual abuse of migrant farm workers. Well, we kept going and looked at what was happening in the janitorial industry. And that's a story that, you know, not many people would ever do. It's very time-consuming. It's hard because a lot of these sources are under extreme pressure. They might lose their jobs. So we're going to take the time to really find those women and really spend the time to talk to them. But that's a world that most of us don't think about. And yet these are the people who are cleaning our office buildings at night. And I think it opens people's minds to understanding, like, what goes into the strawberries they're buying, or when they leave and go home and are very comfortable at home watching TV, what's going on in the building that they just left. And I think people do want to know that. And they engage with us in all kinds of ways when we have public events and talk about these issues. You would be surprised. Yes, it's dark and it's hard, but people are actually often thanking us for raising these things and for giving them some way to understand the world around them.
You spent a lot of your career at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC.
Right.
Can you tell us how you got your start there and what pulled you into this world of journalism and kept you there?
Well, I had come to Canada in the mid-80s after I finished university. I went to university in London, England. And I came to Canada through family connections. So, I mean, when I landed in Canada, I was an immigrant, and I was young, and I had already decided I wanted to be a journalist. And I had done a little bit of work at the BBC as an intern, and I'd worked in a private radio station in Europe. So when I got to Canada, I knew that they had an incredibly well-respected public broadcaster. So I pretty well wanted to work there from the beginning. And I remember, actually, this is true, but I came in, and when you land as an immigrant, you have to do an interview with your, you know, immigration officer as you're landing. And so they ask, you know, so what are you going to do when you get to Canada? And I said, well, I'm going to be a journalist. And they said, well, like, where? And I said, well, I want to work at CBC, of course. And I remember the guy kind of looked at me sideways and said, aren't you setting your sights a little bit high?
Oh.
And I remember saying, no, that's exactly where I'm going to work. Well, anyway, a couple of months later, of course, I was working there. Anyway, I did go to CBC, and I worked in the newsroom as an editorial assistant. I think at one point they used to call them copy boys, but then there were girls too, so they changed it to editorial assistant. And I worked my way up through the CBC news sort of machinery and did all kinds of different jobs. But yeah, I was there for 23 years.
And you were working for the CBC when the Berlin Wall came down.
I was.
So tell us how that affected you.
Well, obviously it was one of those crazy world events that just the entire world was just, you know, mesmerized by what had happened, because there was such a mythology around the Berlin Wall. You know, all the noir movies and spy thrillers and all of this had been built up around this idea that there's this wall in Berlin that basically separates East and West Germany. And when the Communist Party in East Germany, at a news conference that was actually about a bunch of other things, nobody expected that they would essentially just say, we've decided to give people free passage. And we actually had a correspondent, CBC had a correspondent there, and there weren't that many correspondents at the Communist Party meeting in Berlin. I think there's probably a CBC correspondent, maybe somebody from the BBC, but it's not exactly the kind of thing that everybody covered. So those reporters knew right away how significant it was. But a lot of other people were kind of catching up. Well, when I saw it, our correspondent was Patrick Brown. I mean, for me, I just knew this was incredibly important. I was going to change everything. And also because of my background, my mother was born in Germany. She moved to Switzerland. I was born in Switzerland. I speak German. And I just felt like I have something to offer, and I need to go in there, and I need to try and get over there. So I walked into our managing editor's office at the time, and I said, look, I know you're going to be sending a crew over there, and I have to tell you that you need to send me, because I speak German, and I think we're going to be able to be way ahead of everybody if we can really participate in local media. We'll know what's happening. We don't need a translator for everything. And he did.
Did he say on the spot?
He kind of looked at me and he said, let me think about that for a bit. And very soon after, he came out and he said, yep, you should get ready. And, you know, and then, of course, I had to scramble because I was on the plane that night.
Right. And then when you arrived in Germany, did you say, what have I done?
No.
I'm sure you were very excited.
I was very excited about it. And, you know, I never, it's interesting now looking back, I never once doubted that I could make a contribution. It wasn't just like I was kind of, you know, got up my nerve, went to talk to him, and then kind of lost my nerve. Once I decided I wanted to do it, I was pretty determined. You know, all the training of having been bounced around the world my entire life through my upbringing, I think prepared me to be able to hit the ground running and go in there and just, I remember I arrived at the hotel to meet all the various correspondents and producers that were already there. Some came from London, others, you know, Frankfurt. So we assembled a whole team. And it was just like I just walked in and I'm like, hey, I'm here. And of course, right away, I would say, and I speak German. And they were like, oh, great.
Your skill set
so
was needed.
I had to advocate for myself. And it really helped to even the playing field. So I might have had less experience than everybody else, but I had something they didn't have.
How long did you spend over there?
Well, the first assignment was 6 weeks minimum. It was just a rolling, you know, very long days. And obviously, we were just doing everything we could to keep up with it. And it actually sort of almost rolled into the next story, which was then the Velvet Revolution, as it was called, which was the same revolution happening in Czechoslovakia. Because as these different communist countries started watching what was going on in East Germany, they were like, wait a second, we want that too. And so in Czechoslovakia, there were huge demonstrations in Wenceslas Square in Prague. Every night, tens of thousands of people would assemble. And so when we arrived in Czechoslovakia to cover that, we weren't so sure if it was going to be as peaceful, because we were driving in through the tunnels that are sort of surround Prague as you drive in to the city from the airport. And we could see the various armored vehicles lined up inside these tunnels. So actually, that's the first time I got a little nervous.
I was going to say, have you had moments where you were just fearing for your life out there on the
ground? Well, I hadn't, you know, I guess the advantage of having not done that much field reporting was that I didn't have enough context, perhaps, to understand the severity of what might happen. Although, of course, I knew the story of, because I knew from growing up and you know, studying it, what had happened in 1968 in Prague. But I did get some pretty interesting advice from my correspondents who were at that point starting to really trust me and also giving me advice about how to stay safe. And whether or not you're dealing with, you know, a potential Communist Party crackdown, which we were scared of, or any kind of crowd, crowds are very, very dangerous. And I, as you probably know from coverage in the Arab Spring just recently, you know, women correspondents, especially in crowds, I mean, it can get pretty serious pretty quickly. So I was very, very grateful. I got good advice from our correspondents about just because you're covering a crowd doesn't mean you have to go right into the heart of it. You have to basically stay on the outsides, make sure you always have a way to get away. Also, you want to be able to go file. You know, we had to constantly go file our stories. So you want to have proximity to wherever you're going to need to be in order to file your story. So, I mean, it sounds really almost like overkill now, but at the time I got great advice. And he said, you know, you think I'm crazy, but there's probably sharpshooters all around. And he showed me like at the tops of their roofs where they all were. And he was right. They were there waiting. And how you need to protect yourself, so you don't want to be anywhere near the line of fire. So if there's an alleyway where you can protect yourself or some overhang or whatever, you know, just be aware that that's what's going on. And those are all things I learned in a matter of minutes that I had never, ever thought about. So I am very grateful to Patrick Brown, who was the guy who sort of took me under his wing. And he's now retired and lives in up in British Columbia in the off of Vancouver Island.
Did you ever find that being a woman worked to your advantage or to your disadvantage? I mean, how has that ever come into play, or has it, in your career?
Well, I think I always like to be candid and honest. So I think it's gone both ways. I feel that, especially in the field, if you were working as a team, we would often work out like what's the best way to operate as a team. So in some cases, I would be sort of the really, you know, young, dress down, jeans, you know, sort of blend into the crowd young person. And other times I would be more dressed up, wearing a suit, you know, maybe some lower heels. And then they would, some of the correspondents would introduce me as their boss, which in some cases was true later on. So I think it's always important to understand, like, what's the environment where you're reporting? And really, the teamwork, I think, can be an advantage to have members of both sexes in some situations. And I've never felt that it was bad for me to be a woman. I always got things done. But it did sometimes help me that I was actually generally looked younger than a lot of other colleagues. And I have gotten many people to talk to me because I might be a little less threatening.
What is the best advice you've ever received about how to tell a good story, especially when it's something that's hard to hear?
Well, you know, for me, I go all over the country and the world, frankly, to talk to people about this thing. So again, you probably don't want to hear this. We could be here for hours talking about it, but the reality is that I really take it right back to basics. The reason I love audio as a medium, radio as a medium, is how intimate it is. So what can radio do that other mediums can't do as well is just have this conversation that we're having here. One person listening to another person talk. I mean, there's all kinds of science to this, but audio is something that we're hardwired for. We're hardwired for story. We're hardwired for me wanting to hear what you have to say. And so what I try and remember as we tell stories is getting as close to that original conversational, just tell me what happened story. And hopefully getting out of the way, making it as honest a story about what happened to that person in a specific situation, and really letting them speak and trying not to have the format take over. Sound is such a rich thing So we try and share that with the audience, and we try and record our reporters in the field doing their job. So we sometimes will use that too. So you can hear that there are these people going to the ends of the earth to try and find out what really happened. And if we feel it's relevant, we will leave it in there.
Well, thank you so much, Suzanne Reber.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Suzanne Reber, the co-creator and executive director of Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. As part of this week's Inflection Point, Investigating Reporting, listen to our interview with Laura Starcheski, a producer and reporter for Reveal.
I didn't start the interview by, you know, citing a bunch of documents and firing questions at him. I started by asking about his grandmother.
That's our Inflection Point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.